to Season 2 of Cast and Blast Conversations, brought to you in part by Triumph Benefit Auctions. This week, we sit down with Ryan Hamm. For those who haven't crossed Ryan's path, he's a fisheries biologist with the Florida Wildlife Commission. Ryan and I have gotten to know each other over the past several years, as he's often one of the guys in front of our local FWC meetings, be it at Orange Lake, Okeechobee, the Kissimmee Chain, or any of a myriad of other water bodies across our state. Ryan and I ultimately want to chat about the idea of R3 and fishing, but in typical Cast and Blast fashion, we take the long way to get there, covering R3 and hunting, triploid grass carp, basketball, and more. But before we get to our conversation with Ryan, we're going to take a minute to tell you guys about Mark Dobersch with Triumph Benefit Auctions. 863-602-5921. You can call or text Dobe with whatever your next event is, and he can help you put together a fantastic fundraiser. Moreover, most of you don't know that Dobe is a bird dog aficionado. At last count, he had two pointers, a lab, and a setter named Rasta. I'm not kidding when I tell you guys that Dobe is one of us. He's just a regular guy that loves to hunt, he loves to fish, loves cattle. He's just a Florida dude. So make sure you reach out to him for your next event, 863-602-5921 or triumphbenefitauctions.com. That checks off the list of things we need to cover before we get into this. So let's get to Mr. Ryan Hamm right now. Swell with love for us to feel, etc. All right, Ryan, this is the opening question is always the same. Tell us, who is Ryan Hamm?
Yeah, so my name is Ryan Hamm. I'm a biologist with Florida Fish and Wildlife, working in the Division of Freshwater Fisheries Management. Been doing that 12 years, working for FWC.
Did you start when you were 14? Because you don't look like you're that old.
I was lucky enough to get in fairly young, right out of school, after I moved back down to Florida. So I was lucky in that regard, and being able to work in a few different positions within freshwater management, from the habitat management side of things, the fish management side of things. So
you haven't always been in fisheries?
No, actually, I started off permitting grass carp permits across the state. So I would go around and look at retention ponds, make sure they had the right barrier, prescribe stocking rates so that we would have vegetation control, but not too much vegetation control.
And so without putting you on the spot with that too far, you're talking about triploid grass carp, right?
Correct.
And if someone's out of state listening to this, we use those to control hydrilla or all vegetations? Like,
they will control all vegetation.
They'll eat anything?
They have a preference for hydrilla, but they'll eat other vegetation too. Kind of like me, I have a preference for hamburgers.
But you'll eat a salad occasionally too.
But I'll eat a salad occasionally too, or a hot dog. But mostly in public water bodies, small water bodies where we permit folks to use grass carp, or we use grass carp, it is mostly for hydrilla control. But in some of the retention ponds in urban areas, you know, they'll control spike rush and eelgrass and different things that those managers of those particular private ponds
want them controlled
for either water flow or,
and again, we
like
did
that.
This is not on our outline or anything else. I'm sorry, I'm just fascinated by this. You don't want carp to spread, right?
Correct.
Like, you don't want them to get out of their water body.
Correct.
Is that because they'll breed and take over, or because they'll clean out? Because aren't they sterile?
Or are they sterile. It's a really neat process by which they're genetically modified, so they produce an extra chromosome. That's why they're called triploid grass carp, so that they have
45 instead of 44, so
yeah,
they can't.
They're functionally sterile. And then those fish, they need hundreds of miles of swift flowing river and a substrate that we don't have a lot in Florida to reproduce. So we do that because we don't want them to reproduce, because they do feed on vegetation. They're long-lived fish. So we kind of enact a little bit more control.
Gotcha.
On them.
Gotcha. So I cut you off. You were born in Florida.
Yeah. So my family's from Indiana. Starting in the late 70s, my grandpa and grandma had coming down to Okeechobee, staying in Buckhead Ridge, mostly for crappie season. Hang out, fish all winter, go back up to Indiana. One extended stay, my mom was with them on. They had me and stayed in Okeechobee for a few more years before.
That's pretty cool.
Coming back up to Indiana. So some of my first memories of fishing are canals and the rim ditch and airboat.
So you're technically a Florida native, probably the only one in your family by some chance, right?
Yeah, technically I'm the only Florida native in the family.
Family from Indiana, and you were born in Okeechobee.
Yeah.
You can't get much more Florida than that. And then you went to school in Indiana.
Yep.
Purdue.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you have no interest in college football based on that, right?
I'm a basketball fan, yeah. We can talk about basketball forever.
Well, that's right, because you're from Indiana. Like, Indiana is the basketball.
Oh, yeah.
Because you got Purdue, Indiana, mm-hmm. and then Larry Bird went to Indiana State.
Right, yeah.
So, okay. That's fair, because I'm a basketball guy, too. But we're down in SEC country here. Even though I'm not even an SEC guy, like, everybody wants to rant and rave about the SEC. So, I had to at least ask the question. Purdue has had some good football teams.
Yeah, you know, we've had the time we had Drew Brees.
Yeah.
We had some good teams
there. Kyle Orton played there.
I remember one game when we lost two games that year, and one was the Wisconsin on a last second field goal that our kicker didn't make, and the whole, you know, 45-minute walk from the stadium back to the dorms was wide right. And so it was our one chance.
A lot of Florida State fans could probably relate to that from the Miami days back in the day. So, yeah, and the other was Curtis Painter was a – I know some Purdue quarterbacks here because at one point, I remember, strangely enough, there was a Monday Night Football where three of the four starting quarterbacks went to Purdue. You know, that bastion of college football greatness.
Oh, yeah.
Where when you really think about college football quarterbacks, that's where you think of. So, all right. Before we get into some more freshwater fishery stuff, it's our Tuesday show. Let's say this was our Tuesday show. You've listened to our Tuesday show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So you've done your penance to get to this point. And we do drafts of inane objects on there. Music, hot dogs, gas stations, whatever. And we try to get people who are experts in those things to participate in those drafts. So if I'm getting Ryan Hamm to participate in one of those drafts, what's it about?
We can talk a lot about, I guess we talked about basketball. We can talk about basketball players or teams a lot.
Okay.
Big foodie. I like eating a lot of different stuff.
What
you said earlier, when we can't talk about fishing, so that's
if outdoor stuff was off the table. You said soccer earlier. I was gonna make fun of you for saying soccer. That doesn't even count. Like, everyone would turn the radio off. You say you're a foodie. Like, is that a foodie, like, you like to cook food or you like to eat good food or both?
A little bit of both. You know, as time permits, I like to try out making different stuff. Love making different kinds of tacos and using different meats, different toppings and stuff like that. You know, usually when I talk to friends, like, hey, you want to come over for tacos? Like, yeah, you get some ground beef? Like, oh, no. We're going a little higher.
Going wild game? Going something different?
Yeah, so this past summer, I was able to take two gators in one night.
Oh, wow.
On Orange Lake. That was pretty awesome. Got to thank my friend Will for the boat and everything. But we made some mojo marinated gator tacos that turned out really good.
I'll bet those did come out good.
It was good.
Did you make that from the tail, or did you use, like, rib meat or something? Or
it was tail meat, yeah. Tail meat that had been run through a cube.
Nice. Cuber,
chopped up, and then I marinated in, like, that mojo criollo.
Yep.
For a couple days, and then in the pan.
Okay. We're going to talk about freshwater fisheries and biology and FWC, and all anybody's going to ask me is where they can get that marinade.
Like a true Floridian at Publix.
This show brought to you by Publix. So you are a section leader in freshwater fisheries, and we've talked to Alan Martin, who you've worked with for a long time,
mm-hmm.
about black crappie. And we've talked to Eric Weather from FWRI before. So can you talk a little bit about, I'll reverse these questions off our outline. Talk to me a little bit about what a day in the life looks like for you. Because we had Alan do that, so talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, and that's a great question, because a day in the life is no 2 days are the same. We're all constantly going here, going there, either on the lake, talking about plans or looking at data or different things like that. So no 2 days are the same. That's what's one of the things that's really interesting to me. But in general, you know, our research group, by and large, does a lot of our data collection / question answering. So if I'm looking at some data, or I'm, you know, surveying a lake, looking at the habitat conditions, and I've got a question of, you know, is this percent coverage of emergent vegetation good for this lake, bad for this lake, good for this species, so on and so forth, that I can pose that question to our research group. They're the experts when it comes to study design, and
then they'll go create a sample or a study, right?
Yeah, something that's
a model,
something that is statistically defensible, and then they'll give me kind of that output. You know, with any kind of thing like that, you know, in statistics, there's, you know, how reliable is that data, and correlation doesn't always, you know, mean causation.
Right.
So as a manager, we take all this info that's science-based, and then we have to kind of weigh in the different complexities of it. So, you know, information data can say that, you know, if you have this regulation on your black crappie population, this is how it will impact, you know, maybe catch or effort, but it has, you know, very little bearing on, well, what do the anglers want?
Right.
Do they want more fish? Do they want bigger fish? Do they just want a good ramp and clean bathrooms?
Right.
You know, so the role of the manager is to take all the complexities, the trade-offs, and come up with the best management solution given those inputs.
And you'd have to look at social science inputs on that as well, right?
Correct.
And that, it kind of juxtapose those two things.
Yeah, and multiple things. You know, within FWC now we have a center for HD research, which not many state agencies have that yet.
Right.
So we're kind of leading the way there. But we got some really smart folks that are working within that where, you know, they're science, their research is just as robust as, you know, some of our tried and true fisheries research.
Right. So you're studying the human side of engagement onto fisheries management. Is that a
right.
fair way
yeah.
to say it?
Yeah.
So then you guys take, I'm trying to paint this in a way because we've had so many listeners want to get engaged with meetings and show up to things. You guys will then take this and present staff recommendations to the commission. Is that true?
Correct.
So I'm making this up far-fetched, but if they said tomorrow, hey, we're not catching any black crappie in this lake, there's none there anymore. At some point, you guys are going to build some models, you're going to do some studies, you're going to look at the habitat, and you're going to determine, oh my gosh, we need to close that fishery for X period of time. And then you're going to take that to the commission and make a recommendation. Is that a fair way to?
Yeah, in a simple way, yes. The thing about it is, things are never seem to be that black and white. So where you can say in that example, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Black crappie fishing here, spec fishing is non-existent. Well, you know, you go back to our creel information or our trawls, you know, you may have an undersized population, you may have a low recruitment, you may have your fishery is less susceptible to catch, you know, where it's, you know, habitat conditions. The
right.
population is there, or people aren't able to catch them. Then taking that information with what people are saying, you know, what is the solution? Because with any management action, there's always some reaction or trade-off.
Gotcha.
Where nobody is ever happy with a singular solution. So you got to kind of play that balancing game.
All of that dovetails into something that I know is near and dear to your heart. And that is the idea, and we talked a little bit about this with Alan before, but the idea of stakeholder engagement, and you actually were one of the guys that was kind of a team leader around creating the Orange Lake Management Plan, which was what, 3 years ago now?
Yeah.
Give or take, like when you started that process was
yeah.
3 years ago, give
yeah.
or take. And it was basically, I mean, can you explain what that means? Because I know, I'm not sure when this is going to air, but I know right now we're kind of in the process of talking about creating some lake management plans around. You've already got one going for Istipoga.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about Semichain. You're talking about Okeechobee. Like, so can you talk a little bit about how that all dovetails together? Like,
yeah.
like how you guys are working with habitat management, how it all kind of works within the folds of the stakeholders. Just ramble about that.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, the Orange Lake Habitat Management Plan was, as we were trying to manage the lake for what, you know, FWC biologists that are fishermen, hunters, but scientists also, here's what we think the lake should look like, quote unquote, based on the information that we have, the science we have, and our management techniques and tools. But some of that didn't really jive well with what we were hearing from stakeholders. So we had a lot of
duck hunters are saying there's no ducks, or bass fishermen are saying
right.
there's no bass. Like, okay.
Right. So, you know, we strategically wanted to, we have to get stakeholder input up front on what is the condition that folks want in their lake, and also discuss with those folks, here's the sideboards or limitations with us. You know, one of the big issues with Orange Lake is that you have a direct connection to the aquifer through multiple sinkholes. So if it stops raining, the lake goes down. We've also altered the system dramatically with digging of canals, a big highway going across the outlet. So the lake isn't this pristine environment that is can function on its own because we've made so many changes.
It's something I say a lot. We want to consider these lakes all to be naturally occurring lakes, and none of them are naturally occurring anymore because partially because man has put impacts on them, but also because things change to them.
Correct. So one of the, you know, within Florida Fish and Wildlife's mission, you know, the reason we exist is preserving, conserving fish and wildlife and their habitats for the benefit of people. So we really wanted to engage stakeholders, get their input up front, and kind of focus on the issues or management or techniques that they were interested in. So there we went through a about 18-month process. We hired outside facilitation help because at the time we weren't the experts there. You know, we were biologists to help us guide through that process, get stakeholder input, and come up with a plan that really addresses, you know, what are our management triggers? How should we communicate with folks about the management that we are doing? And kind of what are the ranges of different habitat types people want to see on that lake? It's been really successful up there in creating this dialogue with stakeholders, and where there's a lot of trust between the managers up there and the people that are using the resource. You know, this past year, a 15-pound, I think, 13-ounce largemouth bass was caught out of Orange Lake.
Wow.
You know, that all that isn't necessarily tied to, you know, our management plan efforts. Orange Lake is a magic place if you haven't been up there for growing just tons of fish and ducks and all sorts of stuff. But I like to think that, you know, we played a role in that.
Right. And so the goal is to kind of take that model, the model of how to create the plan, not the model for Orange Lake. Because
right.
What the agency realizes, didn't just realize, like you guys have known this for a while, but what you realize is every lake, every water system is different.
Right.
Like, how many lakes are connected directly to the aquifer? That was a weird thing for me to hear.
You know, there's...
I'm putting you on the spot.
So, and I can't answer that question.
Is that
per
a common
se?
Thing?
So, direct connection is not as common because, I mean, when I say direct connection, you can, you know, when the lake is down, it's like, there's the hole, there's the hole, there's the hole.
Wow.
It's almost like, you know, especially when you run down the spine of Florida from Gainesville to Ocala, you know, we sit on this Swiss cheese rock that changes over time. Payne's Prairie is full of water right now because we just got so much input of water. It's Alachua Lake again. And I'm not a hydrologist by any means, and you want to talk about a complex science, you know, groundwater goes. But, you know, a lot of our lakes, like the Harris Chain of Lakes, are called solution lakes, in that the reason they hold water is that layer is basically dropped, you know, so that they can hold water. So we have a lot of groundwater influences in Florida.
Absolutely. But that goes to show the Harris Chain is different from Orange Lake, is different from the Kissimmee Chain, which in the Kissimmee Chain, you may have different lakes within that system as well, Cypress versus Kissimmee versus Okeechobee versus Istipoga. So, and you've been working on the Istipoga plan, right?
I've been working kind of...
Alongside
as kind of like a reviewer, kind of consulting on some of the engagement strategies. But we're getting ready to really head downhill with a lot of our management planning efforts for the Harris Chain of Lakes, Kissimmee Chain of Lakes, and Okeechobee here in the next...
Yeah, like maybe by the time this airs, we may have already had meetings or scheduled meetings or anything else. So, and I want to hang out there for just one more minute. That seems to be a thing that you enjoy, like the stakeholder engagement, the navigation of even in the agency, you have stakeholders, right? Like fisheries, game management,
everybody's
habitat management, like you trying to navigate all that stuff. Like, can you talk about that a little bit, like the complexity of that?
Yeah. So to me, it kind of ties back to being young. I grew up in Indiana, out in the country. We had an old railroad behind our house that, you know, growing up, fishing and hunting for us wasn't a thing. It's like, they can't watch TV because there's nothing on because you don't have cable.
Right.
So we go outside. Okay, I'm going to try to catch stuff, or I'm going to try to shoot stuff, or it's just, you know, you think...
Just thump something you did.
Something you did. And... I'd be out walking around different areas, And I'd always hear stories from my grandpa about his days pheasant hunting with dogs and stuff. And I'd hear these stories, and I'm going out walking around these same areas. I'm like, why don't I see this? Only later in life, you know, as I went through school and got a better understanding of things, how different land management practices impact those species. So I didn't realize it when I was young, but as I was coming through, like, this has always been something, I think, almost within me of wanting to figure out things or work to conserve things. And within Florida, like I said before, everything is a trade-off. And I think for us, FWC, to do a good job of managing our resources for our people, we've got to know what people really, really think. And you can't necessarily get what people really think by having 3 minutes to, you know, talk.
Right.
So that's why with these management plans, we're really wanting to dive into having conversations with people through, you know, small group workshops, through surveys, through interviews and stuff like that. And, you know,
That's one of the things I've told a lot of people that have asked me about attending meetings. And we're recording this the day of a meeting. So I don't know how, there's like this space time continuum in the podcast world. You record one and you never know when it's going to air. So it's like, I don't want to say today, but there was a meeting on the day we recorded this. And a lot of people asked me about attending it. And my word to them, they were like, well, I don't feel comfortable speaking. I was like, well, go meet some people. Go meet Ryan. Go meet some of the biologists. Shake a hand. Meet the duck guys. Meet the plant guys. Meet all these people. Because you can have a real conversation and ask them the hard questions you want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to walk up to the microphone sometimes and be a jerk. Sometimes maybe you do. Like, that's your freedom, but you get 3 minutes there. So there's kind of there can be a back and forth, but not, it's a confined back and forth. You can get off to the side after one of those meetings or before one of those meetings if you get there early enough and really have some in-depth conversations and or exchange emails, phone numbers. Hey, can you call me next Tuesday? I'll be free and give you. I've not met anyone at FWC that wasn't willing to give me some time and explanation if I was willing to respect them in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah. And there's always those extra conversations, and there's always, you know, we're always looking for ways to share information, whether it be through emails, things we post through our, you know, website or our social media accounts. And, you know, if you're a sportsman that wants to know what's going on or why certain things that you see on the lakes or uplands are going on, you know, that's the best way to.
Exactly.
You say this strange continuum. I mean, like, if we're not engaging with folks and vice versa, it's almost like we know it's out there, but we don't really
right
know it's out there.
So you mentioned growing up, you hunted.
Mm-hmm.
And you still hunt, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just setting this up a little bit before we get into R3 stuff, but. What do you're a duck hunter? You're a game hunter? What do you hunt?
God, I love everything.
Do you?
You know, it depends on the time of year. This past weekend I was trying to find hogs in a local WMA with no luck. And then last night I was convincing my daughter that, hey, you should come out turkey hunting with me this spring and
trying to get in on that youth hunt. So you get in there early. And
yeah, she's not quite old enough for the youth hunt. Maybe stick her in a pop-up or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just, Florida's so great that you can do three different things every month of the year.
You really can.
You can go to the coast and fish. You can fish freshwater. You can, you know, hunt basically 11, 12 months out of the year for something. So, yeah, I kind of ebb and flow with what I'm
interested
in.
I just think it's interesting because a thing I hear a lot is, well, no one at FWC hunts. And in my conversations, like, you're a fisheries biologist. You mm-hmm. actually do hunt.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even work in the game management side, but you hunt.
Yeah.
Like, you're an avid hunter. You duck hunt too, right?
Yeah.
You used to, or I don't know if you still
yeah,
do.
Yeah. So, you know, I've got three kids. So,
you don't do anything you used to do,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, you know, before kids, me and my kayak, we lived together through duck season. You know, and so I'd constantly try to play the lottery and win some hunts down south or,
right.
I lived in Lake City and I was able to hunt PCS.
Back when it was still open?
When it was still open, yeah. So it was really, really great. I remember one funny conversation with my brother who doesn't hunt. I was super excited. I called him. I said, hey, Nick, guess what? I got some big, big news. He's like, oh my God, you're having a kid, because it was like that stage of life. I'm like, no, I just shot a canvasback. Because
everyone is nodding in appreciation
yeah,
of that story
yeah.
because that's true. And then your wife killed her first deer. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was it her first deer?
Yeah, it was her first deer. It was really, really crazy because, you know, we've been together for a very long time, and she likes to fish as long as I take the fish off the hook for her. And, you know, she likes to go, but she's not, you know, real passionate about it. So this past year, you know, just kind of out of the blue, she's like, you know, I think I want to hunt this year. And I did a double
after
take.
After you picked yourself up off the floor, you're
like,
okay.
I was like, okay, what would you like to hunt for? You know, deer. Okay, I'll make that happen. So I was able to, you know, work with the NWTF group,
National
Gator
Wildlife
Gobblers,
Turkey Federation,
up in the Gainesville area, and FWC, and had her set up with one of those.
They do a program.
Yeah,
they I forget do the name of it. Do you remember the name of it? I don't remember. It's something in a recruitment for.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know the exact name of it, but, you know, it's basically where you have hunting guys. They go through, you know, hunter safety beforehand. You got to have your hunter safety certificate before. And they take you out to different areas where you have an elevated chance of either seeing game or taking game.
It's potentially either private land or public land that's not even general open or whatever. So it's an opportunity where it's going to be a good opportunity.
Yes. Yeah. So she went out, in November, I volunteered to watch the kids because I was really excited for her to be.
Not this past season. It was the season before, right?
Yeah, it was just this past November.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah.
Then we just finished. Gotcha.
So, you know, she went out. She camped for 3 days.
Oh, wow.
Sat all Saturday. And then Sunday morning, a nice 7-point came out.
And I've seen a picture of this deer. It is a nice. Like,
yeah, it's better than any deer I've ever shot.
It was a nice deer. It has a good wide rack and... That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it was really, really wild because going into it, I was like, you know, she may, it's going to be one or two things. She's going to sit there and like see a deer and just like, I'm not going to shoot it, or the alternative. And, you know, since then she's, you know, we're making plans to go up and hunt different areas, making plans
wow.
for next year and stuff like that. So it's really neat to see, you know, that kind of recruitment phase within an adult, you know, that
in your own family.
Yeah.
That you didn't really trigger that, right? She kind of came to that on her own through proximity to you and or FWC.
Yeah,
and
that's one of our, you know, real struggles with recruitment is that it is such a culture thing.
It's
where,
a golf shot, man.
Yeah.
It's like
it's like, you know, if your whole family hunts and fishes, then you are more likely to hunt or fish. But if nobody you know does that, then the likelihood that you are is probably going to be way less. And, you know, that's one of the main things that we think about when we're thinking about hunting and angling recruitment is how our society is changing, becoming more urban, less connection to the environment, less rural. You know, how do we preserve that fishing and hunting tradition? And I think, you know, this is her example to me is a great example of things we're doing well versus things we can collectively improve on, where
right.
the opportunity that was provided her was an awesome opportunity. I think even if she went through that and didn't shoot a deer, she would probably still be interested because of, you know, how welcoming everyone was and all the things around that.
The environment
that
was the right environment.
It was the
for
right
an entry
environment
point.
For sure. What happens for someone else that maybe went through that opportunity, had a great time, but then they don't have that significant other, that, you know, husband or father figure or wife, sister, whoever it may be, that I'm doing this too, so let's go and do it together.
Right. There's no support system in place
right,
necessarily.
Right.
So let's talk about this for a minute, because one of the things you really... When we first talked about ideas, you really wanted to talk about R3 and fishing,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's important to you. Obviously, you just gave us a good example with your wife, but why is R3 and fishing important
right.
to you?
So there's obviously the personal reasons, and I'll maybe touch on those a little bit later, but from a, you know, fish and wildlife standpoint, a lot of our funding for conservation is funded through people out fishing, whether it be license sales, taxes on
Dingle Johnson.
Yeah, the Sport Fish Restoration Fund, things like that. So from, you know, the ability for us to conserve fish and wildlife, we need people, you know, participating. The secondary thing that I think is really important is just the societal impacts of people fishing and stuff like that.
Explain.
So to me, if someone who's going to generate some sort of benefit from a quality freshwater system, they are more likely to want to protect or preserve or conserve that.
Gotcha.
So, you know, I think if you can envision a world where nobody values the ability to go out and catch a fish, then all the other things that are pressures on that, whether it be development or habitat management or things like that, you know, they would be impacted by that.
Gotcha. So there's an upside to almost an awareness
mm-hmm.
by engaging more, and then talk about your personal reasons.
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up in, I almost didn't have a choice in that.
same. Like, not to go into that arena at all, but I grew up in the church, and they called people cradle Christians if you grew up in the church, because you didn't know any different. It's kind of that way for some folks in the hunting and fishing. It was for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know any different. You just went hunting and fishing. Like, I don't remember. My dad just did one day join the Church of Hunting and Fishing. Like, we just always did it. So
that's,
it was a thing we did. So
it's just something you did. And, you know, I see in my children that where we live and kind of how society works now, there's so many things that compete for our time and our thought, and wanting to have them grow up in a world where they value fish and wildlife resources and see the bigger picture of, you know, the special places that we have in the United States.
What is, I would say on Cast and Blast, we've talked about R3 a lot, but we talk about it typically more on the hunting side
mm-hmm.
because we see those numbers declining pretty precipitously. How is R3 different in the fishing world versus the hunting world? Like, we didn't talk about this beforehand really, but how is that different?
So there are some differences. I mean, recruitment into fishing is a little bit simpler in that the barrier to entry financially isn't quite as great. You know, you don't have to
buy a gun.
You don't have to buy a gun. You know, you can fish for basically $10 if you're a kid, you know, go out and buy an old Zebco. And then there's obviously the training aspect of it. You don't have to go through fisher safety courses to be able to fish.
So the barriers to entry are a little lower.
Barriers to entry are a little lower. And, you know, we do a lot of similar programs that kind of provide that first opportunity. You know, we can hold fishing events in private stock ponds where your chance of success is elevated to kind of.
Can I participate in those? Because I'm a terrible freshwater fisherman.
And that's a really good point, because one of the things, the gap with hunting and the same with fishing, is the mentorship.
Right.
You know, for a kid that maybe, you know, 12, 13 years old, if they have an interest in fishing, generally nowadays where people live and how society works, their parents got to take them either or give them the latitude to ride their bike down to the community pond and go fish. So a lot of our fishing events that we have spread around, we do offer opportunities for where, you know, parents bring your kids and, you know, you can fish too, and you guys have fun with these opportunities.
Awesome. Okay. I'm going to steal a kid and come to one of those. Get my niece. My kids are too old. Like, I don't think I could slide them past the gatekeeper. Interesting. When you were saying that, I thought about growing up. I'm going to just go off on a tangent here for a minute, but growing up, I had permission from my dad to take a 22 or whatever at 13, 14 years old and go into the woods and hunting. Now we do have more parameters around that. Just societally, we've changed. So you don't really, my son's 14. He'll be 14. He doesn't get to just go wander into the woods and shoot things. Like that would be frowned upon societally mm-hmm. these days. But at 12, 13, 14 years old, my parents, I could grab my fishing rod and ride down to the lake and have no qualms about that. So it's a little bit different in that world. So it seems like there's a little bit, you can achieve an independence a little maybe quicker on the fishing side.
Yeah, for sure. And it really, I think in that situation where, you know, like you have a kid fishing on their own, it really allows them to explore their own, you know, techniques or
problem solving and creativity and.
I totally agree. Because, I mean, especially if you're fishing, you know, artificials in a different pond, you know, you got to think, you know, what's the right lure that they're gonna use during this weather condition or this vegetation or this, you know, area, what works well.
Exactly. There's so many variables to catching a fish. You know, doing saltwater fishing, I always tell people, I'm amazed every time we catch a tarpon. Like, I've been in on the catching of a lot of tarpon in my life, but I'm amazed every time we catch one. Like, the odds of something this size in an ocean this vast swimming past something that's hooked onto a hook this size and staying tied to a line this size and you getting it to the boat, like, just... It makes me wonder every time that happens. I'm like, okay, that's fascinating to me. Like, that's just crazy. What are we, and you kind of talked about this a little bit, what are we doing right in R3 in your opinion? Cause you're on the, you guys are kind of on the ground level of this, fighting for recruitment, fighting for more people to get into this. Is a lot of what you do is around, you want more people fishing.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we doing right there?
So I think a lot of our programs that we have aimed at, either recruitment or retention are really good programs in kind of providing that first opportunity or creating kind of a buzz or excitement around our resources. Things like Trophy Catch.
Okay. You know, what is Trophy Catch?
So Trophy Catch is...
I know this. I'm asking rhetorically. Yeah. Go ahead.
Trophy Catch is a incentive program for people to catch, document, and then release trophy bass, which are bass over 8 pounds. So we work with partners in the fishing industry like Bass Pro Shops to incentivize anglers to basically take the photos of the fish they catch and send that information to us. One, so we can kind of collect information on where...
It's almost a citizen science
type.
Yeah,
it's a citizen science program to information on where people are catching these big fish, because a lot of times, while our big chains of lakes do produce a lot of trophies come from areas you would never think that a trophy fish could come from. So we get that information, but we also are able to use that as promotion for Florida bass fishing.
You've done other programs before. Was it, I think it was you and I that were talking about, was it General Sumter or something like that? And
yeah, so we've done other programs that are kind of like partner with incentive based. The General Sumter one was kind of neat. It was in Lake Panasoffkee where we partnered with the local county and tagged a really big bass and released it back in the lake and said, anybody that catches General Sumter gets a pretty substantial prize. You know, and we creeled that lake. So we saw a real
creel
big...
Creel meaning you creel survey?
Yeah,
you,
creel
you,
survey.
You talk to anglers at the ramp.
Yeah, it's a creel survey looking to measure fishing effort and catch and stuff like that. And we saw a pretty big spike in
effort. Did anyone ever catch it?
Nobody caught it.
Oh, man.
But we do other things, you know, with a black crappie where we can have promotion tagging things. And
yeah, I never knew that they were tagged until Alan mentioned it on the podcast.
Yeah, a lot of the tagging that we're doing now is research-based where you're looking at what are the harvest rates and catch rates, because we'll tag a set number of fish, and we're using that information to help us estimate mortality and things like that.
What do you think? So you mentioned you think we're doing a good job in recruitment. You think we're doing a good job in retention.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, what do you think we could be doing better in this arena? But I'm going to ask specifically about reactivation. Like,
yeah.
Do you think that's an area where we're maybe lagging behind or we could do?
Well, it seems to be a real difficult one because it's kind of similar to recruitment, but different in a way. It's almost like you're addressing different barriers to coming back into a fishery, whether it be, you know, lack of money, lack of time, lack of opportunity.
I would imagine in Florida too, reactivation is an issue. I don't know how you guys count this, if you count these as reactivates or not, but people moving here, right? Like if you fish in, when I interviewed Alan grew up fishing for crappie in Kentucky Lake.
Mm-hmm.
That's very different than fishing for them here.
Oh yeah.
And so if you move here, how do you crack into fishing here? Like, what are the regulations? How do I get through those barriers? Because I don't know this place.
Yeah, and the techniques can be really, really different too, or just how to kind of zero in on where fish are. You know, we try to address that by having some information on our website of, you know, fishing forecasts or hot spots, you know, places where we try to provide all the information we can so people can go out and have a good fishing experience. You know, with that reactivation part, we get that question all the time of, hey, I'm buying a house in Daytona. Where can I go fishing?
Right.
So if anybody's, you know, ever has that question, it's always good to just call a FWC office and ask for the fisheries group, because we'll talk your ear off about fishing.
I can vouch for that. What do you think, and this doesn't have to be about R3, but what do you think the biggest obstacles are to R3 and fishing?
Right.
Or hunting, for that matter.
I've got
thoughts on it too. But
I'll go back to the mentoring part. Is, you know, I feel like we're really good about creating buzz. We're good about providing opportunity. And I think a lot of states or other people thinking about R3 struggle with this too, is how do we provide mentorship? You know, that's a bit of a gap in my mind. And I think it's a gap nationwide, because we have these societal changes over time. And I think for us to affect that, we got to, you know, think bigger. I don't have all the solutions there either, but I think that's something we can improve.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know on the hunting side, I'll make this up, but it's something like, if they don't have a mentor, their likelihood of participating beyond a single hunt or that event is like 8% or 12%. Like, it's a really low number. It's not good.
Mm-hmm.
So you put the effort into getting the person to the event, and then if you don't have the mentoring framework around them, they don't go on. But I also think, and you're a dad, you see this, I also think you got societally just changes in the world we live in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we grew up in a time, we're not far off in age. I think you're a little younger than me, but we're not far off in age. You went outside when you got home from school.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you came in when the lights came on. And now, you know, my kid is enjoying hunting. He's enjoying fishing, but he's also competing for his time with video games. It's also competing for his time with other stuff that goes on. And I think that's a thing that, maybe this isn't the right word, but there's like a lack of sexiness on one side of that discussion versus a polished video game or a polished internet or whatever, iPads and all these other things that can kind of grab onto this generation of people. So I don't know how to fix that problem, but I think it's definitely a challenge.
You know, this is my personal opinion, but, you know, I think you go back to that example of when we were young. If I had a PlayStation, a tablet, cable TV, and a dresser full of cool toys, maybe I wouldn't go outside either, but it's just the amount of stuff coming at us was just less. And I think the idea that we have to separate our young people's worlds as they are from, we have to unplug them, take them out of this, and then place them into that, you know, the hunting, the outdoor ideas. If we take that approach, I think we're going to lose. So we have to, in my mind, find ways to
blend
the two. You know, whether, you know, I'm thinking about this with my daughter in the turkey blind this spring, is like, I'm bringing a phone. I'm making sure it's fully charged, so that if she gets bored,
right
here, you know, hang out for a little bit.
There's
some mental downtime.
There's a patience I teach with ducks, because I do a lot of R3 on that side. And there's a patience I teach with parents and ducks of getting them to go is a big part of the battle. Like, let's get them out there. And I get bored some days when the birds aren't flying. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can look at all the dads in the boat. We're all on Facebook. We're all on Instagram or something, because it's just a slow morning. Like, that's kind of what it is. So I think we have to be patient sometimes with our kid, because we want them to go and be in love with it day one, because that's kind of how we nostalgically remember it being, that we always loved hunting. There were days when you didn't want to go hunting. There were days you didn't want to go fishing. There were days it felt like work. So I think we have to be very measured in our take on how that worked. What does a win look like in R3 or in your world? What does that look like?
You know, to me, I think a win really is, and this is pretty lofty, I think, given all the things we've talked about, is that no net loss, where we can maintain a number of anglers or hunters at some point, to where, you know, we're working through our baby boomers kind of phasing out. We have this millennial generation coming through. They're starting to have kids. You know, they're not as connected to the environment, but oftentimes in a lot of research, you see that people, when they're like 18 to 25, they've got college, they've got new jobs, they've got, you know. So trying to get that segment of our population turned back into the outdoors, and kind of investing in their value of nature and fishing and hunting and stuff like that, I think is a win.
Well said. All right, Ryan, we're getting ready to wrap up here in a minute. I know you came in, there was a few other things you wanted to touch on while we were doing this. So what else is on your list? Like, what's at the top of Ryan's mind today?
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned some of the things we do right. And I think some of those opportunity things we're doing right. I did also want to mention our Florida Youth Conservation Network.
What is that?
So it's basically a network of partnerships that we help set up and maintain with, say, like a Boys and Girls Club or a camp for kids, where we provide some of the materials or the programs for youth outdoor education, and then our partners will kind of enact that stuff. You know, it's a way that we can do more outdoor education than with what we would be able to do with just the staff we have.
Right. It provides almost a framework for volunteer or partner education.
Yeah.
Is that a fair way to say it?
So, and when we're able to provide some equipment too. So like if a local Boys and Girls Club, say, wanted to have an archery program or a casting skills program, they wouldn't necessarily have to go out and buy all this stuff.
Bows and arrows or targets or whatever.
So I think that's one of the things we really, really do well. And another thing is our fish management areas.
Okay.
We have fish management areas spread throughout the state. A lot of them are in urban areas where we do kind of intensive management, where it be stocking, sometimes feeders or access management. And that's really aimed at providing that easy opportunity. So someone in the middle of Orlando doesn't necessarily have to drive an hour south to, say, Toho to go fishing. They can stop by, you know, like Turkey Lake or Lake Ivanhoe and have a really good fishing experience.
That's awesome.
So
I was familiar with fish management areas. I didn't know what the term meant.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the states have different, you know, acronyms for their different water bodies that they manage. And, you know, it started with our urban ponds program that kind of dovetailed into fish management areas. So we have ponds that we manage pretty intensively in Jacksonville, Orlando, the Tampa metro area in South Florida.
That's
and then others spread throughout the rest of the state.
Okay, Ryan, I appreciate you giving us so much of your time today. If people are listening to this, they're like, wow, I'd like to follow up a question about archery and fishing. I want to follow up a question about Ryan's wife's deer. They want to follow up a question about anything. Can they reach out to you?
Yeah. You know, we're here to serve the public. Best way to reach me is probably through email.
Okay.
Which is ryan.ham@myfwc.com.
So it's Ryan, R-Y-A-N,
yep.
Dot ham with two M's.
Two M's,
H-A-M-M, at myfwc.com.
Yep.
Man, I appreciate so much the work you guys are doing, the effort you guys are making, and you taking the time to do this with us.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much to Ryan Ham from FWC for being so generous with his time and sitting down with us for this week's conversation. For more information on how to get into fishing in Florida, fishing regulations, lake management plans, and more, make sure to check out myfwc.org. We'd also like to thank y'all for listening to Cast and Blast Conversations. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review on iTunes, share the show on social media, or with someone you think would enjoy it as well. Don't forget you can financially support the show at our Patreon link, and don't forget our regular Tuesday podcast / Trainwreck, Cast and Blast Florida. We hope y'all have a great week.